What are the similarities and differences between Hawaii and the historic mining town of Butte, Montana?
I think the differences, or the main difference, is one is incredibly white. That being Montana, and Hawaii isn't. It's so ethnically diverse. But similarly, or the similarities are that, or the ones that I think affect me and make me feel the most, Hawaii has a lot of just kind of hardness, grittiness, brokenness. And I would say that Butte, Montana does as well. But from those sorts of things come strength, character, tenacity, vigor. Yeah, and I like those things. That's my favorite similarity.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with multi-genre writer Matthew Haynes about Give Us What We Want, his forthcoming collection of linked short stories that all take place in Hawaii. Don't go away. Oftentimes when we think of Hawaii, I would say in popular culture, we don't think of grit and sort of that darker underbelly, which I love that you explore in your writing. One of your nonfiction pieces was featured in Fringe magazine, in which you wrote, "I tried to explain to Chuck that I knew more about Hawaii than they did. I knew the dances. I knew the music. I was better at learning the language. I had my mother's stories about old Hawaii, and I was Hawaiian. I was Kanaka. Though not of Hawaii, I was part of Hawaii. They were the transplants." Can you tell me, what does it mean to be Kanaka, and what is your relationship now to Hawaii?
To be Kanaka is to be of a place, of Hawaii, of Hawaiian ancestry. It's tricky. I've lived in Hawaii as an adult 3 times now. I lived there for a bit as a child. I look incredibly Polynesian, though I am mostly Irish. But I look very Polynesian. But I don't sound Polynesian. I can speak Pidgin English. I taught at Kamehameha Schools, which is a private Hawaiian-only school in Hawaii. And it was very confusing for the kids at first. They looked at me and they're like, "Oh, uncle," you know. And I'm like, "Hi, my name is Matthew." And they're like, "Oh, what's wrong with you? Why don't you sound like me?" So it's a tricky connection. My mother is from Hawaii, from Maui, very Pidgin, very local, grew up incredibly poor, and lived in that broken world that I try to write about a lot. But I'm not, so I'm an outsider-insider, and that pause, that place that I kind of feel is a pause, can be very difficult. I think some locals would see me almost as an imposter, but others see me as a bridge. It's very strange. But my kind of relationship now with Hawaii is I hold it in my heart, but I hold the Intermountain West in my heart. I have 2 homes, it feels like, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was hoping that you would take us to Hawaii and read the beginning of the story, Losing the Moon.
Yeah, I would love to. Losing the Moon. "When you left for good that morning, I was awake but couldn't bring myself to stop you, knowing we only get as much time as any string of moments can offer before the knot slips. I took that whole week off and followed the pattern of you I'd come to know, an early rise, a cigarette on the lanai, staring at the sea, waiting for that dolphin you swore was a past you. What you hadn't discovered of me was that past my leathery skin and tobacco lips and all my chill nature, a crater had formed from your presence. These things happen, so I stopped following you."
This line, "a crater had formed from your presence. These things happen." What did you mean by this?
I think that when things are incredibly important, I think they cause craters. Sometimes they can cause, you know, batholiths. They can cause other things, but I think incredibly important things create craters. They create deep pockets and maybe partially fillable later on, but never completely paved, you know. There's always going to be something there, some sort of crack. And these things happen. I just think they happen. And I'm never sure if it's for better or worse. I'm not sure if that even matters, but they do happen.
I love this geological metaphor. And I see this twinkle in your eye, and you say batholiths. And I know this area around Butte. And I was wondering, can you just describe, what is a batholith?
It's like this, oh God, I'm going to get it wrong. But to me, sorry, geologists, I think there are plenty of batholiths. And I lived in Idaho for a long while. I went to Boise State, and there's a huge batholith there. But they're these massive, at least the ones I know of are granite, but they're these massive rock formations. And I believe they're just one. It's not like an amalgamation of different rocks having pressed together, but these just huge miles high, wide, deep, however we want to say those dimensions. Big rocks sitting above ground.
Losing the Moon is addressed to a you. What is the conversation you're in as a fiction writer? And as a nonfiction writer, is there an emotional core of truth that you bring into your fiction?
Yeah, as a, I think all of my fiction begins with a nonfiction. Maybe not with an essay per se, but it begins with a nonfiction. In this specific collection, all the stories began as ideas. I tend to write from idea and then move out. And with Losing the Moon, I was wondering, is it okay to just come into someone's life and leave? And maybe care, but maybe not. Maybe you just need, you need that person for that time, for that week or that month. And or you just desire them and then you just leave. And I was trying to explore that idea, because I think that's something that many of us experience. We may not intellectualize it, but I think there is the emotional like thread there, or emotional teardrop, or whatever it is that's there. And that's what I was trying to explore. So in my fiction, I definitely am looking at these emotions. And yeah, they almost always come from, I write from my life, for sure.
I can't wait to follow the thread of presence and absence later on, as it relates to your other story we're going to talk about. But later in Losing the Moon, you write, "Remember that small inlet where we used to swim naked, where we'd make love and name new constellations? They found Sada there, beaten and drowned." So this move you make, you know, conflating love and newness with violence and endings. What were you trying to do with a flip like that?
I think it goes back to this kind of end line inside of the story, which is, I don't want you to feel bad for having come or having gone. We're always just choosing one thing over the other. And that, I mean, that pool, it's just a choice. They could have gone into the pool, made love, and then fought. They could have thrown stones. They could have filled it up, covered it because they hated it. The things that we use to create memory, they're tricky. They can be lovely, and they can be hard. And I think that's what I'm trying to explore in the story in general, is that there's the other sides to all the things. And that's one of them. Yeah, a love pool can also be a death pool.
I loved that line, "We're always choosing one thing over the other." Clearly, you're working with that in your writing. And I wanted to know when you were faced with that kind of choice, or how you move through in terms of even choosing where you're going to live, or what jobs you're going to take, or how you're going to move artistically, or in even your personal life.
I am the worst with choices. I mean, I'm not kidding. My closest people when I become friends with someone, they have to learn of me that I am that horrible dude out at a restaurant. Like, so on that burger, the mushrooms, like, are those cremini mushrooms? Are those? And honestly, you know, I'm horrible at it. So I used to carry around a quarter and I would pick two things and flip the quarter. And then they invented this quarter flipping app. So now I can just press the button and it will tell me which one to do because I have a hard time with choices. So with that said, it's part of why I also wanted to write this story, because I think that the choices that become incredibly important are the ones that we make in that very moment. They're not the dinner choices. They're the ones where we can't not choose what we're just about ready to choose. We just can't not. I explore that in a different story in this collection. And I explore it in almost all of the stories. It's just we're choosing things and to not get too bent out about them. There's no undoing it. There's maybe some like backtracking, but you know, you can't undo a thing, I don't think. And nothing can ever be the same as it was. It can be similar, but yeah. So it, even in, I think, in my love life, it's difficult to choose someone to love, because what if there's someone else to love or three other someones to love? And it's not about having made the right choice, just that there are other choices. And because I'm bad with choices, let's just have like 12 white Hanes t-shirts in my closet, because then there is no choice.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Matthew Hanes about his short story collection, Give Us What We Want. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. The other story I wanted to talk about specifically is called One of Those Times, and it's written about a couple renewing their vows in Hawaii. And of the wife, Charlotte, you write, "She wasn't responding because she was still thinking about the unfathomable things that people think about when they know they are walking a plank." This feels to me like both a very true and vague statement. How do you enter the lives of your characters, and or how do they come to you? You say you start with sort of a nonfiction place or in a place of ideas, but specifically?
I think with this story, which was, it's the genesis story of the entire collection, I was trying to understand for myself why I should continue in a relationship or why I should not continue in a relationship, and the things that we, the royal we, do to either blind ourselves or open ourselves. I'm not sure. I think that's, again, one of those strange two sides to a coin. Yeah, I was just trying to figure out, like, do we renew vows and is that a smart thing or do we not? I remember this couple, this friend couple of mine in Boise, Idaho. They, on their anniversary, they would sit down with each other and have a meal and like wine or bourbon or who even knows, I don't know. But they would sit down together and they would ask each other, "Do you want to do this another year?" So that's where I came from. I thought that was a beautiful idea. Like, hey, if you're really going to be honest with another human, do you want to do this for another year? And up until that point, they hadn't said no. But what I wondered was, what if you did?
Yeah.
What if you're sitting across from lover and they're like, "Hey, Matt, you want to do this another year?" And I'm like, "Oh, no, I definitely do not want to do this another year. Pass the Brussels sprouts."
Right.
I don't know. So then I was just thinking about a vow renewal ceremony. My parents were married twice to each other. They were married, then divorced, then married. I've always been curious of that, why people stay with each other throughout years. Yes, I wanted to explore what it means to to try and reignite something. And I wonder about whether or not maybe something should just be left dulled. I don't know if reignition is wise. What if that's just the natural pathway of the thing? And maybe what we need to do is resculpt our like neural pathways to say that dull's okay.
Yeah.
Maybe dull is just fine. Or maybe it isn't for me, but it is for you, and that's cool. But to maybe stop expecting so much, and maybe in the expectation, therein lies the danger. But that could also be exciting, I guess.
And the fact that this story unfolds in an exotic location, you know, of course, holds some sway. You acknowledge the fetishization of Hawaii. And from Charlotte's point of view, you write, maybe Hawaii is where people come to decompose. And then you write, Charlotte wonders if this is how it happens. At some point, life turns to monotony and patterns and excuses until you go to Hawaii and you see the sun on someone's face. Maybe that is what Hawaii is for, to remember that people can still be beautiful. Matthew, I'm from the other exotic state, Alaska. And I feel like people come to Alaska to be reminded of their inner wildness.
Mm.
And I wanted to know, what are you trying to work through in seeing Hawaii, both as an insider and an outsider?
I think Hawaii foremost is seen as a paradise.
Yeah.
It is maybe the biggest reason for writing this collection is I want to explore it beyond the paradise or through the paradise. Yeah, it's seen as a paradise. I mean, that's where people go to honeymoon. Most people don't come to Butte to honeymoon. That isn't like a hot destination. It's Bali, the Maldives, or Paris, or Hawaii. But when I lived there, Hawaii is constantly decomposing, right? It's an island. I mean, the Big Island of Hawaii, it's just, it's in a process of decomposition. It's so warm, it's so humid, things grow and die and grow and die, and quickly. The island is constantly growing. Kilauea is making new feet every day. It's being washed away. Kilauea is also destroying suburbs.
Kilauea is the volcano.
Kilauea is the volcano there. Yeah, the active volcano. But I think that people go to Hawaii oftentimes to get away, to feel renewed, to languish, to absorb. But there's a whole other life. There's people there.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that Charlotte tries to maybe notice in that story is that, you know, there's cars rusting and maybe the Hawaiian man there looks a bit rusted. Yeah, I mean, people are still trying to live. Like, they're trying to work at the Chevron, or they're trying to work at the Mackenzie River Pizza Company, and they have two kids. And they're not there to renew their vows. And they're busting their butts. It's hard. Mm-hmm. And that to be pressed up against trying to re-see someone is maybe what I'm trying to look at. Yeah, that it's just a contextual beauty.
Coming back to this theme of the absence of people by death or by leaving, and the way we grow or stagnate around that kind of loss, I guess what can you say about longing and absence?
Longing and absence, yeah. I think that the longing creates the absence. I think that's what it is. I don't think if there was longing, there wouldn't be an absence. It wouldn't matter. And this collection, another theme I'm dealing with is the things that do matter and the things that don't, and trying to tease those out, which is incredibly difficult, and not feel terrible and guilty maybe when things don't matter. I'm philosophizing throughout this collection, kind of like, not completely, but The Unbearable Lightness of Being, right?
Yeah.
The book by, is it Kundra?
Milan Kundra. Yeah,
Kundra, yeah. To make it all lovely, we have to attach, right? We don't have to, but attachment creates the loveliness of the things. Detachment, which so many of us strive for because of maybe the suffering of the life. But then if we're completely detached, what does it even matter?
Right.
So trying to see that balance. So yeah, longing, absence. We have to long for a thing for it to be, to even matter if it's gone.
This takes me to this place in both of these stories where there are characters looking at the horizon over the ocean and, you know, staring at the sea, so to speak. What is it you're trying to get your readers to see through to or beyond in that kind of, you know, visual plane?
A really close friend of mine who is a nonfiction writer and teaches at Boise State University, so she's in Boise, Idaho. Open spaces, I never understood this about open spaces. She prefers the comfort of mountains and pine trees, right? Douglas firs and just anything, anything with a pine needle. She likes to feel enclosed. And those big spaces make her feel really uncomfortable. And I really didn't understand that until I was an adult, staring out at the ocean. There's just so much of it. And all we see is the surface. I feel like that about humans. There's just so many of us with so much skin, but we just don't know what's below the surface. There's so many times I think, gosh, I'm just never going to know the human. I'm never going to know a human. Sometimes I'm not even sure if I know myself, you know, but I'm not going to know that person, even when they tell me whatever they're telling me. And I think that is what I'm trying to work with, is that there's this grand expanse beneath which most of us can never know. And, well, we just can't know because there's so much of it. And then the question, I think, becomes to obsess or to just leave it be. I think that's what I'm trying to explore in those images.
You've referenced the collection, and these stories come from your forthcoming collection, Give Us What We Want, which all take place in Hawaii and have interlocking narratives, as I understand it. And these are the stories that had you selected as the 2017 Lambda Literary Fellow, which then turned into the Lambda Literary Fiction Writer in Residence. How did that come to be, and what has it meant to you?
Yeah, it came to be over so many years of writing this collection. It took a long time. I'm not prolific. I struggle with sentences and words and syntax. I am a syntax nut job. I can't stop thinking about it. I'm a comma crazy person. I can just trip out over a sentence for way too long. So not prolific. But I began writing these in Boise, and then when I moved back to Butte about 6 years ago now, I finished them up. So I had a writing group in Boise. After graduate school, a few of us formed this writing group, and we met at the same place, the Owyhee Hotel Lounge, right? This historic hotel. And we would meet in the lounge, which was so... just the, like, puffy leather chairs and the red candles, and it still smelled like people had been smoking. But we met there. That group, until I left, we'd been meeting almost every week for 11 years. And so the collection, so many of those writers had eyes on it, and so I had a community to read those stories. But then I finished it up here in Butte. I finished it up... boy, let's see. Right as my mother was dying, my mother recently passed a couple of years ago, or a year ago, it just felt like it was ready. So I started sending it out. I had been submitting to the Lambda Literary competition for, I don't know, 8 years. I mean, I really wanted in. And in 2017, Garth Greenwell was the judge and fiction mentor that year, and he had selected me as one of the 12 fiction fellows. Yeah, and then they invited me back as a writer in residence that following year, where I was able to really cement, I think, the collection, work on it line by line. I had 1 week at the Otis Center for the Arts in Los Angeles, living space, meals, the ocean, where I could just really line by line go through these hundreds of pages to make sure they're good. Yeah, so it meant the world to me. It allowed me the time, the energy, and it put me, I felt like in a way forced I had to finish it, or else I just, for me, I wouldn't have felt, I don't know, I just wouldn't have felt like it was, I would have used the time well if I hadn't completed it then.
You say you're not prolific, but you are a multi-genre writer, fiction, nonfiction, poetry, screenwriting, and you have a collection of multi-genre writing, Shall We Not Go Missing. What do you find in that space of blurring the lines between genres?
Truth. I find truth there. You know, when I'm teaching nonfiction writing to any student, I begin with kind of talking about how to essay, to write an essay, means to try. It means to attempt. And we're attempting to understand something. But I think that's what I'm doing in fiction. I'm trying to understand something. I'm trying to understand why someone would want to have a vowel renewal. I'm trying to understand why craters are formed. I'm trying to understand something. And then I'm going to deliver that to the reader in some sort of like character plot way. And in nonfiction, I think that we use similar devices, obviously, to get there. But I think all of the writing, all of it, is looking for just a truth, a kind of truth, an authenticity about something. And that may change. That truth just moves on maybe throughout our lives. The truths I came to when I was 23 are not the truths necessarily that I am arriving at this morning in my car. But I think that's what I'm looking at. I think that's what's in those spaces are truths, shared truths even. We're just arriving at them differently through different genres.
Lastly, Matthew, what's your version of paradise?
Oh. Holy cuss, that's a hard... What is my version of paradise? To not be bored, for things to not be ordinary. I think, yeah, boredom and ordinariness seems pretty dang hellish. I mean, if the opposite of hellish is paradise, then I would say to be stimulated and just for things to not be ordinary sounds delicious.
Matthew Haynes lives in his hometown of Butte, Montana. He's the author of the novel Moving Towards Home and the novella Friday. His short stories and essays have been published widely. He's a State of Idaho Fiction Fellow, Lambda Literary Fiction Fellow, and Lambda Literary Fiction Writer in Residence. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.